thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 81, recorded February the 3rd, 2012. Is there a story here? Well, welcome back to another edition of Digital Campus. It's a beautiful spring day here in February in Virginia. I think it was 70 degrees on Monday or Tuesday, and now it's about 60 degrees and sunny, and the flowers are getting ready to bloom. So it's clearly spring, even though it's February. But just remember, global warming is a hoax, and I ought to know because I teach a course about hoaxes. I'm Mills Kelly from the George Mason University's Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media, joined by our regulars, Dan Cohen. Dan, how are you today?
I'm very good. I'm running the 8,000 hair dryers from the top of the Center for History and New Media to make it seem as if it's warmer outside than it really is.
That's what's in that tower. I thought it was.
Yes, you know that tower right next to my office? Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was a telescope. Okay, so it's
giant hair dryers.
Okay. All right. And Amanda French from AmandaFrench.net. How are you, Amanda?
I'm fine, Mills. I actually was very cold this morning for a while. I was sitting sort of hunched over at my computer working from home, and I kept thinking, why is it so cold? It seems like nice and sunny out. I realized it was very cold because I'd left the door open.
That'll do it. Well, you just need to get closer to the hair dryers and you'll be fine.
I know.
You'll be fine. But it is a little freakishly nice here. We're expecting no snow, and we're happy about that, I guess, except for the sledding problem. So today on the podcast, we're perhaps a little puzzled about the content of our podcast because there are stories, some of them, which don't strike us really as being stories, but maybe they are. And as you listen, you can decide, or you can just click off right now. The first one has to do with the tempest in the teapot, at least it seems to me, about Google's new privacy policy, or as some people would call it, their lack of privacy policy, in which now they're going to have the same policy across all of the various Google instantiations. And Dan, Amanda, do you have a take on this? Is this a big deal? Sure made a lot of news, and there's an EU investigation about it right now as we speak.
You know, I got to say, so I guess the summary of the change in the policy is that, you know, they are now the all-knowing eye and see everything and combine everything. In other words, areas of Google that were once off-limit to other areas like YouTube are now all part of one big soup of knowing you and what you do and watch and search for and email. A little bit scary, but I have to say, I kind of thought they were doing this already. Did I miss something? So I guess they couldn't advertise something to you in Gmail based on what you watched in YouTube. That came as a bit of a surprise, but nonetheless, it's a little bit disturbing. I don't know if I'm more disturbed by that or how lousy the search results are getting in Google with this additional Google Plus stuff showing up.
Yeah, have you noticed that the search results have gotten worse?
Yeah, you know, I feel like I should be trying other search engines, and I know other people are doing this, but maybe I'll start with switching to Bing on my phone or something like that. I don't know if others have done this. I know some people are trying DuckDuckGo, lousily named DuckDuckGo, but, looks a lot like Google circa 2001. I'm not sure if that's a upgrade, but it's a very stripped down kind of basic search engine. I tried a few searches on DuckDuckGo, and it is true that it is not cluttered by AdSense or Google Plus messages, but it didn't strike me as that wonderful either.
Amanda, what about you? Are you now totally freaked out that Google is watching everything you do?
No, I'm not. I had more or less the same response as Dan, and I actually got notified so many times about Google's new privacy policy, I sort of just, you know, deleted those. I almost think, in a way, it's almost a little misnamed. It's not even, I mean, it is obviously a privacy policy, and they have actually combined the text of a number of these policies into one document. But apart from that, you know, sharing information with different units in the same company doesn't even strike me as being exactly a privacy issue. But, you know, because really it is more of an operations issue. And actually, I was very pleased to see that this didn't apply to every single thing that Google does. Like, they excluded Google Books, for instance. I noticed that. You know, they're not looking at what you read in Google Books and feeding that to other Google services. There were a couple of other ones I noticed that they omitted. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I'd call it, you know, a tempest in a teapot, or, you know, sound and fury signifying nothing. I mean, there's probably some reason to investigate this. And it turns out they had a congressional hearing. They were called before a congressional committee yesterday. But no, it didn't really bother me that much, frankly. Seems fine.
Yeah, I kind of had the same reaction that Dan had, which was, you mean they're not doing this already? Like, that this one of the, you know, the most sophisticated technology companies around, and they weren't already combining data sets? What's up with that?
Well, you may remember that there was a, you know, kind of hilarious privacy irony a little while ago, a few months ago, back in October, when Steve Yeag, an engineer at Google, wrote a long screed on Google Plus about what was essentially this very issue, where he said, look, the different units of Google are far too separate and they don't talk to each other nearly enough. And he held up Amazon as an example of a company that does this really well, where Amazon, you know, not just information, but actual sort of tools and services. Amazon has a really good internally integrated system for all kinds of things. And he wrote a long post and accidentally shared it publicly on Google Plus, which was the kind of hilarious part where he didn't really mean to. But, you know, the tech press took that email and said, oh, this is absolutely true about Google. You know, it's far too fragmented and it's not doing enough to, you know, integrate its services and platforms. So this strikes me as a step in that direction. So good on you, Steve Yeag. You know, what you have suggested seems to be starting to come to pass.
Yeah, the thing that I guess the only part about this that concerns me is the fact that, and this is something we've talked about on the podcast a lot over the last couple of years, is how colleges and universities spend so much money on sort of closed email systems or not free email systems like the one that our university here uses, that require a lot of person power and a lot of just a lot of time and effort, when services like Gmail are, while not free to a university because there still has to be some kind of customer support that goes on, are a lot freer and work a lot better than the email system our university offers us. My worry is that the kind of sound and fury that goes with stories like this then just predisposes people to stay away from things that work well, like Gmail. So
yeah, Tom and I have the commercial version of Gmail, actually the Google Apps for Your Domain. So we both got the much more elaborate new privacy statement from them, you know, because they assume we're a company or organization, which is kind of annoying, right, that they can't figure that out. And it does strike me that, you know, in there, there's a kind of a longer thing about how data that, you know, I assume this would be the same thing for colleges, like, within my dancohen.org domain, how that might circulate, you know, within and outside of it. I just wonder, though, about, we've talked so much on this podcast about the permeability of this wall now between the kind of consumer tech and the academic tech. And I think even with this possibility of, let's say, a campus does adopt Gmail, that there'll be leakage of personal or private information out from the I guess, cloistered Google Apps domain for your university out into the bigger world. Because, you know, the other thing that they often ask you also is to, like, connect up your accounts. Like, hey, is this your Twitter account? And, I get those messages all the time. And, you know, they just want to get as much stuff aggregated as possible. And, you know, I didn't think we had don't think we have it on the lineup for today to talk about. But, you know, with Facebook going public, it also seems like, you know, now there's these two really large aggregate companies, that Google and Facebook, that really have a tremendous amount of information that includes a lot of college student information. It's hard to see how that doesn't kind of spread out way beyond the university.
Well, but it's, your point was a really good one, Mills, because actually what I was thinking about with this, there is so much information within a university that should be shared more, you know, and a university is small compared to Google or a Google user base, but just within a university, there's a great deal of information that would make the university infinitely better if it were shared better across different units. I heard a great presentation by our own Patrick Murray-John a while ago, before he even worked at CHNM, pointing out that the university bookstore is the only entity on campus that knows who's assigning the same books. So that, for instance, you know, there could be a chemistry class assigning Frankenstein and a literature class assigning Frankenstein, but nobody's ever going to know that, and those classes are never going to talk to each other about their different perspectives on that book because nobody has that data. The same thing with badges, the whole badge competition. You know, yet another thing that sort of annoys me about that is that even though this is it's laudable usually to do this kind of connecting across. You know, this is just the connecting that digital tools can do, but it seems like it would be so much more useful to create systems that can do that within the existing infrastructure. Like with badges, I don't know why they're setting up whole new credentials that can be interconnected, you know, in a number of different, across a number of different organizations, when, you know, everybody knows that doing transfer credits from one university to another is just a big, enormous pain. So why can't we work on systems to make that kind of thing easier and more shareable? You know, so I'm all in favor, usually, of spreading information around so as to make things more efficient within the bounds of reasonable privacy. So.
Yeah, as long as we just give it all to Google, and then they'll give it back to us in a usable form. So...
why are we resisting this?
Yes,
it's the future.
We must give over to
give
Google.
All data.
Again, remember that Google has the data liberation front. You know, you can always get all of your data out of Google. You're not required to use their services, even less so than something like at a university where, you know, they've got your transcripts and things. So,
I bet you now if you go to the Googleplex and you go into the dark basement where they keep the data liberation front, they probably have like duct tape on their mouths right now. They're in like a bat cage with the servers.
It could well be. Well, certainly there is a conspiracy website devoted to that issue even as we speak, because Lord knows there's a conspiracy website for every issue. another story that we were looking at for this week is actually more of a story, I think. You know, I was joking about things being non-stories, but and we'll come back to another what seems to me a non-story, but a non-story story, but one that is a story seems to me is the growing unhappiness with Elsevier Corporation and its business model, which has resulted in a boycott that seems to be gathering some steam. I forget which, Amanda, were you the one who brought this up originally on the podcast a while ago?
I think Dan may have brought it up originally. It was one of his predictions, I think.
Right. So Dan, tell us about the boycott.
Well, I think this all springs from the Research Works Act, which I think we discussed on the last podcast or maybe podcast number 79. But, you know, this is one of those cases where, you know, in the dark of night, literally on the Friday Eve before Christmas Eve, the 23rd of December, lobbyists for the AAP, the American Association of Publishers, really evidently driven by big commercial publishers like Elsevier, pushed for the introduction of an act in the House of Representatives in the United States that would roll back the open access provision that has generally been driving funding from places like the National Institutes of Health, where if you get a grant from them and you publish an article based on that grant work, you have to make available an open access copy of your work because you are doing that work based on taxpayer funds. This has been going on for some years now. The sky has not fallen. The end of the world has not come. Elsevier continues to make billions of dollars, and yet
billions. Let's remark on that. Billions.
Yes, I mean literally billions of dollars. And this reminds me of the old Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons, who previously had the wonderful comic strip Life in Hell.
Oh, I love that comic strip.
I don't know if you remember that great comic strip where he says, you know, what will the music industry do now that there are blank tapes? This is back in the 1980s, blank cassette tapes. And the conclusion was, instead of making billions and billions, they will only make billions. And that's, you know, I think that's what's happened with this open access provision at NIH. You know, instead of making billions and billions, they'll only make billions of dollars. And but, you know, this is how politics works, and it's ugly. And what I think is sort of, frankly, hilarious is that, you know, they are shocked by this response that people had when they finally found out about the Research Works Act. And there was a lot of grumbling. And then one field medalist set up a special website. So the field medal is like the Nobel Prize of mathematics. And I can't remember the mathematician's name. Someone at Cambridge. Sorry.
I'll pull this up. Timothy Gowers.
Yes, thank you. Timothy Gowers. So very well known, you know, very famous mathematician. Set up a really simple website, thecostofknowledge.com, signed it and said he won't publish, won't referee other works or do editorial work for any journal associated with Elsevier because of three business practices, which have really hurt academia and the communication of scholarly knowledge. He wrote that they charge exorbitantly high prices for their journals. Indeed, a journal like Trigonometry can cost list price $60,000 a year. It's just like the American Historical Review, isn't that
exactly.
$60K a year?
Yeah.
You know, they bundle their journals, which is a sort of classic business move that was adopted by the cable industry to begin to charge Americans $200 a month for crappy TV because they could say, well, you're getting
we're getting
500 channels. We have to raise your rates again.
And there's something good on one of them. I know it.
Right. So bundling is, you know, become a big thing. And they support the Research Works Act and SOPA and PIPA and all these things that are really, you know, pretty blunt attempts to kind of take back from the public market for information. So, you know, I just think it's sort of like the reaction that happened in the public to SOPA, where people kind of woke up and said, you know what, this is just going too far. And I don't think that the lobbyists for the AAP or Elsevier expected this kind of reaction because, you know, these things kind of just float their way through various committees. But I think it's kind of reached the point in 2012 where people are a little bit fed up by this. And especially in a recession where library budgets are crunched. And if you're on the history or humanities side of things, like we are, you see monograph purchasing going down because so much of the budget is taken up by science journal publishing. I just think it kind of hit a breaking point. And as of this podcast, which we're recording on Friday, February 3rd, 2012, there are over 3,500 scientists and other scholars who have signed on to this protest site and saying that they're just not going to do work for Elsevier anymore for free. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, I think some of the critics have said, oh, you know, there's been boycotts before and they never go through because people are worried about publishing in, you know, the most prestigious journals. And those are all owned by companies like Elsevier. I'm not so sure on this go round. I think that particularly the pledge not to referee other articles is something that will have actually quite a big effect on editorial boards, the editorial process. So we'll see. I mean, we've tended to do that peer review for free. And I think if enough people speak out, some of this process will start to slow down.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the members of these editorial boards, because I think that the next step in the, because they're people in the same scientific communities. And so it'll be interesting to see what kind of pressure then begins to be exerted on them to not provide that service. And so that too, I think, will be quite interesting to watch. I do think the environment is different now, and which is why I think that you're right on this, Dan, that people are just kind of tired of this sort of thing. And I remember the first time I ever thought about Elsevier Corporation was we had a presentation here by, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the man who's in charge of the Open Knowledge Project in Vancouver. It's gone right out of my head. I can't remember.
John Walensky?
Yeah, Walensky. And he talked about Elsevier, but he talked about it in a different way, which is that how this was creating, this business model was creating a stratification of knowledge around the world, because only in the rich economies can scholars and students afford to have access to this information. And so, you know, he gave an example of, you know, I forget now which African country could possibly afford one medical journal, and that's it. Based on their, you know, for the whole country, they could afford one medical journal because their library purchasing budget for the, all of their universities was such that they could afford one medical journal from Elsevier.
Wow.
And and so, what does that mean for healthcare in those countries? And so,
I mean, they do, places like this do have graduated pricing usually, so they usually do knock off a little bit, you know, if you're a poor thing. But in general, the point is exactly right. And I think, I mean, in general, in the last 15, 20 years, there's just this increasing sense that we don't need this distribution model anymore. Just with the internet, I mean, archive is the example, you know, archive.org is the example that people hold up all the time. Somewhere, Timothy Gowers was saying, you know, what he thinks a better model would be. And he says, well, a better model would be to post them in open online repositories and have what he called sort of free-range editorial boards that ensure the quality of these things. And I mean, that's the thing, is that, you know, back in the day, in the print era, you know, if Africa couldn't afford it, well, then Africa couldn't afford it. But we realize now that it's extremely easy to make it available cheaply to Africa if we want to. And so a lot of us want to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and there are fields that have made this transition. I mean, I would say probably in certain areas of physics and mathematics, you know, really the real work gets done completely in the preprint, you know, open publishing array. I mean, things do end up in published journals, peer review journals, but really all the work is recognized at a very different stage. I was following a very interesting discussion kicked off by Paul Krugman of the New York Times and of Princeton University, The Economist, who also talked about, you know, economics now, and actually for a couple of decades now, has kind of worked in this alternate method where, as he called it, the kind of final journal article was a kind of tombstone to one's scholarship. You know, it was you know, a place where the scholarship ended up. But he said even when he was, you know, early in his career I believe it was at Harvard, that really everyone in the know was just circulating working papers. And that's been true actually in physics for a very long time as well. But that now, he said, so much is going on in the blogosphere with economics that, again, it's sort of where the rubber hits the road for them, is that much of the big debates are happening in kind of an alternate universe where, again, the journal article itself ends up as a kind of tombstone or, you know, necessary CV line. Now, whether that spreads to other fields, I think, is a really interesting question. And I think it's, you know, there are some sort of culture-based things that go on here that are, you know, vary between different areas. But, you know, I do think that it's at the point where people would be willing to experiment at least. And that's, I think, what makes it harder for someone like Elsevier. Whereas, you know, the critics who brought up this 2001 boycott sheet, which I think had 10 times the number of names as this current one does so far, although I have a feeling it's going to end up in five digits of signees. But, you know, that one back then, you know, there weren't all these open access outlets. I mean, the Directory of Open Access Journals now lists over 7,000 journals. So there are actual alternate journals that if one wanted to, you know, and even if you just take a little bit of a reputation hit maybe to publish in a slightly less known journal, but one that's open access, you could easily make some minor changes that, that might alter a field.
Yeah, I think it's that final point that you made about the just the incredible proliferation of open access journals means that it's just really not necessary. And I love the image of the tombstone, because it had never occurred to me that an article, the publication of an article, might be the your way of saying, okay, I don't have anything more to say about this. So, I've said what I can say.
It's a lot like a monograph in history of the humanities. I am so sick of this. Please take it away from me.
I actually tweeted a few weeks ago something along the lines of publishing is so slow in the humanities that it's really more like archiving than publishing. You know, it's the same idea. Like in the digital humanities, we see this all the time. We're blogging, we're tweeting, we're talking to each other, you know, via email, publishing things online. And yeah, it's so much faster than the publication schedule will allow for, you know, going through all of the, getting to the top of the line in the backlog that the journal has and all of that.
Yeah. I think the Economists are a really good example of that, Dan, because, here at George Mason, Tyler Cowen, who's one of our top economists, he's probably best known worldwide for his blog Marginal Revolution, not for books that he's published, of which he's published a number, but, you know, you see him quoted in The Economist of London, and he's quoted regularly for what he's writing in his blog, not for what he's published in his books. So
he has a much bigger influence through his blog.
Right.
So, you know, I think probably in the past, I've talked a lot about the speed of publication, which, you know, doesn't matter as much in, say, history, where things are kind of the Victorian age will stay where it is. And you're not writing about, let's say, the recent unemployment rate changes or money supply or something like that, that the econ blogosphere obsesses about. But I think beyond that, though, I think what every field really can use, even if, let's say, their subject matter is relatively static, is it's the reactiveness, right, of the blogosphere, or the ability to kind of have an open debate, discussion, etc. That I think that's what's really attractive about it for all fields, where you could, we already kind of do that, let's say, in history by giving a paper, you know, where your thoughts are maybe a little bit half-baked or, you know, inchoate, and you know, moving up from that to something that's much more polished. But you can imagine a system at which really much of the kind of core of your argument gets exposed in a different way much earlier on. And that, Amanda, like you said, I think that's a really great way of putting it, that, you know, what you have at the end is a kind of preservation path for your finished version of the scholarship in some kind of journal or book or what have you.
And that's actually quite important. You know, it's important to have a final copy, you know, the point at which you say, I am not working on this anymore, at least not in this form. And, you know, and something that can be indexed by the major scholarly indexes so that it can be found by something other than Google, you know, something more precise. So, you know, I'm certainly not against publishing in journals per se, but it's no longer the real way people communicate. And so to spend this kind of money that people do, that libraries do on the journals, is beginning to seem increasingly silly.
Yeah. Well, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how all this goes, because it is, as we've just indicated, it's bound up in a whole lot of issues all at the same time. Another story that we've been following that is one I have to admit that I'm just kind of fascinated by is the sudden or seemingly sudden appearance of supermassive online courses, you know, with 65,000 students in them, you know, the population of, you know, a small state. At Stanford, and there was this artificial intelligence course. And I think we're going to see more of these over the next year or two. And so I'm sort of fascinated by it because I don't even understand how you do that. I mean, I know it has to be all done algorithmically, but still, it's fascinating to me as an instructor how you could possibly wrap your mind around a population base that large all at once. But the more interesting story that's come out of that is now this one of the people doing this, Sebastian Thrun at Stanford, has left Stanford to found his own university, online university, which, okay, the name You could debate how it's pronounced. I think it's probably Udacity. I'm going with Udacity, but just because it sounds better to me, like Udaman. But Amanda, now you have signed up for one of these courses, haven't you?
Yes, I did. When the announcement came out that Stanford was offering certain free, massive online courses, I said, what the heck? And went to the website and put in my name and email, and that was about it. I signed up for Human-Computer Interaction to be taught by Scott Klemmer. They originally said that the course was going to start in January. They never gave any more specific date than that, and that they've sent us an email and said, well, actually, that's going to be in February. And in that email, they said that 65,000 people have signed up for this Human-Computer Interaction course. And, you know, that's where we are. Me and 64,000 of my close friends are going to learn about human-computer interaction.
Did they say which year? February?
2012.
Okay.
So it should be by the end of the month. I'm willing to cut them some slack, you know, because as you say, I can't wrap my mind around 65,000 students. But I mean, I think the answer is you don't. You don't wrap your mind around them at all. You know, and the one that I'm taking is not part of any startup spinoff. It's still Stanford branded. I will apparently at the end of this course, assuming I don't just, you know, drop out, which is certainly possible. At the end of this course, I will get some kind of acknowledgement that I have completed the course.
You're going to get a badge, Amanda.
I knew you were going to say that. No, I think, you know, I think it's supposed to be something signed, some signed thing. I assume he doesn't sign all 65. Can you imagine even signing 65,000 pieces of paper? No, I'm sure they're, you know, it's a photocopy of a signature that I will get. Should I complete the course?
If you get a badge, you have to post it on your website.
Okay, I promise, Nils. If I do get a badge, I will post it on my website.
Well, so what do we think about this, though? You know, as a historian, I quail at the idea of more than 50 students in a class. I've taught very large classes. I hate them. I know from my own research on students' cognitive abilities and their ability to pay attention in large classroom environments that it doesn't happen. That very little learning happens in these very large lecture courses, but this is a different thing. This is you know, a series of online modules, and you pay attention. You can stop when your attention starts to fade, and then, you know, reconnect with it at your own pace. So asynchronous learning has the potential for overcoming the problem of the huge lecture classroom, but what do we lose anything in these super massive courses that is important in higher education?
We must. We just must. I mean, it's interesting to me because I have mostly taught seminars, and a key part of that seminar is creating a sense of the course as a group and the course as a group of people who are all experiencing the same readings or so on and talking about them together. And that to me almost is education. You know, it's always so difficult to come out with what are the learning outcomes for this. I do come out with learning outcomes, but basically it's just, look, we're all going to read this book. We're going to share our perspectives on it. And one of the things that we're going to learn about that is that we all have different perspectives. Hey, what do you know? You can't do that with 65,000 people. So, but it's clearly like a vastly, vastly different model. But what's kind of interesting to me is that the internet in general is already kind of an engine for asynchronous learning. I mean, when you're learning to code, or when you're, you know, trying to solve a specific problem, you know, basically what you do is you Google it and you find that somewhere out there somebody has posted some blog post telling you how to do what it is that you're trying to do, right? So there's this very informal way in which the internet is already doing this kind of thing. So not having ever taken it, not having any idea how this is going to go, it seems to me that in the abstract, a 65,000, you know, a 100,000 person course has kind of the worst of both worlds, where you don't have that group of people that you're, you know, experiencing things with on a particular timeline, and yet you also don't really have the total freedom and flexibility that the asynchronous learning of the free internet gives you. Because, you know, you're supposed to, this begins and ends at a certain point, apparently, although that certain point is sort of a floating point. But, you know, so I don't see why do it now.
Yeah, I mean, surely I mean, this is going to work for certain kinds of, or work partially for certain kinds of courses. You know, can you have a course on the causes of the American Civil War with 65,000 people?
Probably not.
I'm just not so sure about that. And, you know, I'm really interested to hear from Amanda and report back on a subsequent podcast about this. But it reminds me, there's a very good blog post up on the Atlantic Tech site by a professor of English literature, Alan Jacobs, the very wise and smart Alan Jacobs, on his experience on learning how to code. And he just, you know, kind of uses the open web, or as he put it, learning not how to code, because as he put it, he's sort of like the functional coder, is sort of like, oh, I need to tweak my CSS. I'll just Google similar CSS and then I'll find that and then I'll cut and paste it. And then I'll tweak a couple of the attributes and everything will work out great, you know? And so, and he was saying, you know, is this really learning how to code? Isn't, you know, aren't there just so many shortcuts that I'm just not going to really learn? And, you know, and so my extension to that argument is, well, maybe this is like one step up from that. You sort of know the open web is out there. You can go out and find code snippets or user interface snippets and kind of look under the hood and kind of play around with it. And he wasn't quite sure what to make of this. And, you know, that's what I'm also wondering about these, that, you know, maybe for certain skill acquisition learning modules that would work. And I guess that's really the idea behind Code Academy, right?
Yep.
In the code year. Does it work for more metaphysical things? I'm not so sure, you know. But I did write back to Alan on Twitter that I said, you know, maybe this, what he was doing already informally is, you know, the 2012 version of wax on, wax off. You know, that maybe through repeated kind of looking at the codes, the HTML source of a web page, or, you know, looking at the CSS for his website and tweaking a few things, or tweaking WordPress PHP, that he had kind of made his way up to the ability to do something much more sophisticated. But maybe a course like this will really help you, Amanda, and evidently 64,000 of your friends learn how to do things in a much more robust way.
Yeah, I think it's not very much a skills course exactly. I've read, you know, desultorily about human-computer interaction before. I've even toyed around with going to get another degree in it. But I think, and actually what I understand is that the course is literally going to consist of watching videos. You know, they will release a new video and
oh,
you
wow.
watch it.
That's
and
exciting.
That's I've it. Got, I know.
I've got course fever.
Yeah.
So, you know, ooh. I mean, like you could.
Cutting edge.
There is something. I'll just be interested to see, like, what kind of tools, if any, they have for the 65,000 of us to talk to one another, because that seems to me sort of so essential to what any kind of education really is. Even in your large lecture courses, supposedly, you know, you should have study groups and discussion groups so that people can kind of talk about what they're learning. And I mean, you know, they have a, you know, Ken Burns is the Civil War. When they air something like that on TV, people talk about it, and that's a kind of learning, you know, that's a kind of public history learning. So it's not even necessarily the skills based. There is something about all of us are doing this together that I think does engage learning, but I'm not clear that this course is going to let the 65,000 of us talk to one another. And, you know, in that case, I'm probably just going to give up halfway through and like stop watching the videos, because what social motivation do I have really?
Right.
Apart from learning for its own sake, of course.
Well, exactly. And it strikes me that like 65,000 people all trying to talk to each other sounds to me anyway, sort of like Twitter. But so the.
But wait a second. And I think what's interesting here that we haven't mentioned is, you know, that, and I believe this was my prediction for 2012, but, you know, these professors who, so it's this one guy who left to start
Uda City.
Oh, I am seeing an internet meme right here. And then two other Stanford professors who were teaching another very, very large course. They didn't quit, but they kind of got some help from Stanford to set up a company. I can't remember. It also has kind of a lame name, CourseAware or something. I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, you know, it's going to put all these kind of weird pressures, right, on professors that, you know, why would you teach 100,000 people for your regular salary or even an enhanced regular salary when you could own 50% of a company or 5% of a company? I don't know. The whole thing is there's going to be much more to say about this year when other star academics start leaving academia to make oodles of cash.
I actually think this must be just a stratagem on their part to just avoid students. You know, they just say, oh, you know, I have 65,000 students. I can't possibly respond to any of your emails or great complaints or, you know, it's very smart in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's going to be, it's going to be very interesting. And I sure hope it turns into an internet meme. That would be great. Because I would just feel so good about myself if I had actually started one. The last story that we looked at in this, now returning to our theme of possibly not a story, is that in the last podcast we talked about the big splash of Apple reinventing the textbook, and boy, was there a lot of media hype about that, and you know, things happened and there were events and all of that. And I haven't heard another word since then. And I'm wondering, is this truly one of those things where the publicity cycle reached its peak and then just died? I doubt it, because Apple is generally better at that. But boy, did this story seem to just go away to me. And it's not like it was replaced by the exciting news that Google had changed its privacy policies. you know, there wasn't something really major that blew it off the blogosphere. It just seemed to go away. Have you guys noticed that or not? Or maybe
I just think everybody realized, and I think we discussed this on the last podcast, it's just how hard it is to get new educational materials into the classroom. I mean, there's just all these, you know, mechanisms that prevent that from happening. And I think in the first 3 days, they quote unquote sold 350,000 textbooks. But of course, we don't know how many of them are the like little trial life on earth, just a few chapter versions. Nothing was broken out. We have no real numbers. We've had no numbers since then. I did go ahead, since I was talking off the cuff on the last podcast, as we like to do on this podcast. I downloaded iBooks Author, and I was playing around with it, and I was trying to figure out, how do you make a footnote? And then I realized you can't make a footnote in iBooks Author.
That cracked me up. I saw you tweet that earlier.
No, this cannot be. I am very dumb. And I went and had like another cup of coffee. And then I trolled the internet and went to the Apple support forums. And I found all these other people, a lot of them professors, who were like trying to make a textbook, saying, how can I again link to this citation? And then other people saying, yeah, I haven't found that menu item. And I think we collectively realize that there is no footnote function in iBooks Author.
Well, now, wait, can't you just hyperlink to whatever it is? Or no, because you need to footnote something that isn't online.
They're all right. Yeah, no. Like, let's say you just want to cite. Yeah, exactly. Like a book.
Right.
So there are all these like hacks. Like some people said, well, you make a glossary and then you like have a touch-based link to the glossary, but it's not a glossary. And, you know, oh, but I can make a cricket walk across my page.
You know, you know, Dan, I got to say, when you said that, I just had this flashback to a podcast of your when Second Life first appeared, and you talked about being a squirrel in Second Life. I don't know why I remembered that, but
I still have nightmares about my day as like a giant squirrel person. I know, that's how I felt. This was squirrel person too. I just, you know, I live in this new medium here, and I just sort of was stunned that they wouldn't have basic scholarly apparatus like Footnote. But, you know, maybe that's not what it's for. Maybe someone tweeted back at me and said, the footnote is the flash of the books. You know,
that's like, not true. I mean, there's so much. I mean, not everything is online, okay? Digital campus audience? Not everything is online. Not everything is going to be online anytime soon. And even stuff that is online, you know, maybe it's not entirely online. Google has done a lot of scanning of books that you can only get a preview snippet to. You know, what's the point of linking to that? I don't know. Yeah, it's foolish.
Well, we will see if this story ever resurfaces. Will there, in fact, be an Apple textbook market or not? We could, of course, just be full of hot air here on the podcast on this one, but I sure would like to think that we're not. So, and for those of you in Denver, Colorado, in our audience who are listening, sorry for the global warming jokes, because I know that you've already gotten like 2.5 feet of snow today. I've been getting emails from my mother-in-law about this, who lives in Denver. So
they like that in Denver because it's good for the ski slopes, which is good for the economy.
Well, except you don't ski in Denver. That's
well,
the
right,
problem.
But
that's the problem. So if we have any listeners in Denver, sorry about the global warming jokes. To everybody else, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you again in 2 weeks.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country